This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Thank you, Ben and Katie and Allie and Jamie. We are so thrilled for your leadership. And thanks to you, Carolyn, for your wonderful, wonderful beginning to our evening of our week of worship last night as we thought about the call of God upon Moses' life. And tonight we'll be thinking about the work of God through the prophet Jeremiah. So we look forward to hearing from you again this evening at 7 o'clock as we worship together. So this is another moment in which we merge the Eli and the WIM gatherings together. As each morning we're going to be led by Jamie Smith. I'm thrilled that Jamie is here. Jamie's on the faculty at Calvin College. As we got feedback about Jamie from our colleagues at Calvin, particularly our former provost, Michael LeRoy, who just became president at Calvin last year, what we heard over and over again is that Jamie is one of the most popular speakers among the students at Calvin College. Well, that's all you need to say, and we knew that Jamie was going to be great here. So Jamie's the author of 16 books, so I'm not sure what you're doing with all your spare time, Jamie. But we are grateful for your commitment not only to scholarship but also to writing. Jamie's in the middle of a three-part work on cultural liturgies, and this first book, Desiring the Kingdom, published in 2009, was actually named the Christianity Today Book of the Year in 2010. The basic thesis of the book is this, and this is what Jamie is going to be helping us think about during this entire week, that we are formed and shaped by all kinds of cultural liturgies. And in the shaping and the forming of those cultural liturgies, we are set at odds with what God wants to do in our lives. And so how are we reframed by Christian liturgies? Not just in terms of how we think about doctrine, but about how we live our lives as the community of God's people. And that's a trajectory that we're going to be on during this entire week as we listen to Jamie. His second book, Imagining the Kingdom, is the second in the trilogy, and the third one is in process right now, as I understand it, right? Long ways away. All right. But well, Jamie, with all your spare time. Just this morning, our president, Beck Taylor, handed me a New York Times editorial written by David Brooks. It's a review of Charles Taylor's A Secular Age. One of the things that Jamie's working on is a book on Charles Taylor. And in this New York Times editorial, Jamie is quoted just this morning. So hot off the presses. When faith is a matter of personal choice, even believers experience much more doubt. As James K.A. Smith of Comment Magazine, who was generous enough to share his superb manuscript of a book on Taylor, put it, "We don't believe instead of doubting. We believe while doubting. We're all Thomases now." So we look forward to Jamie's leadership with us as each morning we think about Christian liturgies and cultural liturgies. And just as a sidebar, for the first time yesterday, Jamie had the joy of experiencing a huckleberry milkshake here in the Pacific Northwest. So, Jamie, welcome. Please welcome Jamie Smith.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Love the huckleberry milkshake. I didn't even know there were such a thing as huckleberries until Sunday. It's such a pleasure to be with you. This is my first visit to Whitworth, first visit to Spokane. Heard so many great things, know so many folks coming out of Whitworth. It's such an honor to be here. I love it that Ben has brought together in the music the Dutch Reformed and Scottish Presbyterian tradition, so I immediately feel at home. We are members of the Christian Reformed Church. I was explaining to my kids yesterday, they asked, so my kids have grown up CRC, they go to a Reformed Christian school, and they asked, what are Presbyterians? And so the way I explained it to them is I said, well, just think of us as kind of Dutch Presbyterians. And despite the fact that their last name is Smith, that made perfect sense to them. They knew exactly what we meant about that. I also, you're never supposed to do this as a speaker, but I really need to start with a proviso, which is this. I am not a preacher. So I'm not even going to pretend I am a preacher. And the last thing I'm going to do is actually try to expound the word to a sanctuary full of preachers. So think of myself here in the mornings in the mode of teacher. which is nice because you've just had your coffee, and so I can invite you to put your thinking caps on a little bit, and we can explore some approaches to things. And then, thankfully, Carolyn is going to keep bringing the word like she did last night each evening. So I think there'll be a nice complementarity between what we're up to here. You might think of the theme that I want to invite you into this week in this way. The future is ancient. The future is ancient. And what I mean by that is that I think the way to think about spiritual formation, and this is anybody who knows Jerry Sitzer, this is going to sound old hat, but the way to think about spiritual formation in our postmodern world is actually to recover very ancient intuitions from the Church of Jesus Christ. And that actually those deeply resonate with much of our postmodern context. I'm especially intrigued to be in the Northwest and to be in Washington. I hope it's not out of turn to say, I always think of this as one of the most secularized states in the country. It's one of those regions, you know, where it's, I come from West Michigan, where everybody's a Christian. Whenever I'm in Seattle or in contexts in the Northwest, it feels like a little slice of Norway or something. You're just in a very different world. But I actually want to suggest that the ancient wisdom of the church is exactly the resources we need for a postmodern proclamation of Jesus Christ, one that is unapologetic, thick, particular, embodied. And so I think we have something to learn from the past, Michael J. Fox notwithstanding. The other way that I'm going to frame this is to suggest that discipleship is centered in worship. Discipleship is centered in worship. I am a bit of a theological mutt in a way, in that I was converted to Christian faith when I was 18 through the Plymouth Brethren. Our family has a long then pilgrimage in the Pentecostal and charismatic traditions. I was trained by Augustinian Catholics, and I am a Reformed philosopher and theologian. So you can think of this two ways. Either you can think, wow, he's sort of an ecumenical blend that has, or what it means is I end up offending almost everyone. But I do think that there's some shared intuitions at the intersection of that. The sense that discipleship is centered in worship is sometimes going to feel Catholic. And I want you to understand, I'm totally okay with that. I actually think one of the best things that can happen to Reformed and Presbyterian traditions is that we remember we are Catholic. Doesn't mean we're Roman, but we're Catholic. We are part of a historic body, and I actually think there's a lot of resources in that. So this morning, I want to lay out a picture of the human person as the starting point for thinking about spiritual formation. And I don't know if you notice, in your packet, there are some outlines to help you, A, either follow along or doodle while you're bored. And if you would turn to session one, our theme for this morning is we are what we love. Folks, the other thing I'm going to do is, since I'm more in a teaching mode and less preaching mode, I want to try to save time at the end of each session for Q&A so that we can learn in interaction and conversation with one another. So keep that in mind. Here's my opening axiom or thesis. Every approach to spiritual formation implicitly assumes some understanding of what human persons are. Or every approach to spiritual formation and discipleship implicitly assumes something about the nature of human beings. Okay? Now, the problem is, I think we don't realize the extent to which the North American church has absorbed very modern pictures of what human beings are. So what has happened is, unwittingly, we have implicitly started to assume a picture of human persons which is not an ancient biblical model of the human person, but it is actually a kind of picture of human beings that gets rolling with people like René Descartes really builds up steam in the Enlightenment. And even as we might be, as Christians, reacting to that model, we end up mirroring that model of human persons. And it works simply like this. We have a bad habit of assuming that human beings are basically thinking things. Or, as I sometimes put it, we kind of functionally assume that human beings are like brains on a stick. So what happens is you kind of unwittingly kind of assume that human beings are these intellectual receptacles who are defined by what we know, what we think, and what we believe. And the way we think about knowledge and faith is in a very intellectualistic mode. Now, I want to pause immediately. I earn a living as a philosopher. So, this is not some sort of anti-intellectualism that says we shouldn't think. In fact, you're going to be frustrated with me because I'm going to be asking you to think at 9 o'clock every morning for 4 days in a row, okay? But what I'm saying is we have unwittingly sort of overestimated the significance of ideas and beliefs and intellectual heady doctrines as if those define who we are. So if you unwittingly assume that human beings are these thinking things that are really defined by what we know, then you will also assume that the way to sort of shape a person, to change them, is to deposit and input the right beliefs, ideas, doctrines, and so on. Does that make sense? So sometimes there are pedagogies that go with this. We think of teaching in that way. But there are also models of discipleship that work the same way. If you effectively think that human beings are thinking things, you will then also tend to assume that the way you are going to become more Christ-like is by getting more knowledge, the right knowledge, the correct ideas into those intellectual receptacles, and then bam, you look like Jesus. Also, what will happen is if you functionally assume that human beings are thinking things, brains on a stick, intellectual receptacles defined by what we know and believe, you will also worship accordingly. And actually what you will get is a lot of, I say this as one of us, historically reformed Protestant liturgy, which is come in, sing a few songs, sit down, 50-minute sermon. Why? Because the most important thing is that we make sure you get all the right information in your head, giving, prayer, so on, and then we get up. In other words, if you look at a lot of models of North American worship, they do tend to also assume that human beings are thinking things. We're defined by what they know, and therefore the most important thing we can do in worship is disseminate information. Now, I want to suggest that that is an inadequate picture of the human person. It's not that what we believe and think and know isn't important. I just think we actually tend to overestimate its significance because we have this picture of the human person that is top-heavy. It's a bobblehead view of the human person. You know bobbleheads? You go to like the Mariners on one day and they give you these bobbleheads, which is this tiny little body and this humongous head that's bobbling around. We kind of functionally work with bobblehead views of people and disciples. And so we spend all this time focused on sort of heady stuff and we pretty much shrink the body's significance to nothing. And then we worship accordingly, we think of discipleship accordingly, and so on. I want us to step back and entertain a very different model of human persons. It's a model that I think its pedigree is biblical, because it's going to be centered in the scriptural emphasis on the heart. Its more proximate resource is St. Augustine. So pretty much everything I think about anything is ripped off from St. Augustine, okay? But I actually think it has a lot of contemporary relevance. So let's think about what defines us. Instead of us thinking about what defines human persons in terms of knowledge, I suggest that we actually are defined by what we love. That human beings are not first and foremost thinkers. Notice the qualifier there. They are not first and foremost thinkers. They are thinkers, obviously. But they are not first and foremost and fundamentally thinkers. They are not even, and this is where we might get a little uncomfortable, first and foremost believers. Human beings are fundamentally lovers. We are defined by what we love, by what we desire, by what we long for. And one of the things I think we have to work through is that this biblical and Augustinian intuition about human persons also sort of explodes a dichotomy that we often receive between, we all know that you guys especially know, there are these three Greek words for love, eros, phileo, and agape. Okay? And we have often received this dichotomy and tension. Eros, well, that sounds erotic, so it's got to be bad, right? Agape, well, that's really good love. That's biblical love. Here's the thing. I think in the biblical vision, and certainly in St. Augustine's picture of this, eros and agape are not dichotomous and opposed to one another. Agape love is rightly ordered eros, longing, desire. There's all kinds of disordered eros. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But actually what goes on in this biblical picture is that to be human is to love. And to love is to long, desire, crave. There's an attractional dynamic here that we need to think through. So let me try to unpack this with a really lame diagram, okay? This diagram you're looking at in the outline is just showing up the limits of my ability to manipulate MS Word, okay? But think of it this way. I'm getting all excited. Let me slow down for a second. In the thinking thing model, what I think is really problematic with it is such a static picture of the human person. The person is basically this sort of intellectual receptacle. You're defined by what's in there, what you know, what you believe. And the task of discipleship and spiritual formation is to deposit more items into that receptacle or the right items into that receptacle. I want to, instead of that static picture, imagine a much more dynamic picture which sees the center and seat of the human person as an orientation. Not a container that has stuff in it, but as this is what I'm going with the arrow, okay? That is, to be human is to always be after something. To be oriented to something. To be aimed at some end. Okay? And in philosophy and theology both, especially from Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, that end to which we are directed, that target that we are aimed at, is the shorthand term we use is our telos. Our goal. Our end. And you'll see that teleological language show up in Paul as well. It often actually gets discussed in terms of perfections. But I said I wasn't going to talk about the Bible because you guys know that way more than I do. So to be human is to be this kind of creature who is made with an orientation, this aim towards some end that is ultimate. And the fundamental mode of our orientation to that end is our love. So if I really want to know what you are about, if I really wanted to try to dig down and understand what makes you tick, what makes you you, I am not going to ask, what do you know? Because there are all kinds of things that you know that aren't real, that don't define you. I actually am not even going to just ask, what do you believe? The answer that I want is to this question. What do you want? What do you want? What do you long for? What do you love? Now, that's a really mean question for this reason. We don't always love what we think. We don't always love what we think. I take this to be a deeply Calvinistic insight, which is this. If I ask you, what do you love? You know the right answer to give me. That's very different than actually knowing what you, at this fundamental gut level, love. That's, now we've just inhabited that gap of sanctification. And so, in this picture, but that is what drives you. That is what defines us, is our loves, our longings. So instead of imagining this kind of top-heavy, bobble-headish picture of the human person that is so fixated on discerning what is in your mind, now you'll notice that the center of gravity in this picture is shifting. And now the question is, what do you love? What do you want? What do you long for? This is why the seat and core of the human person, as described biblically, is the heart. The heart. In the opening of his confessions, Augustine, you know, the whole of the confessions is a prayer. It's written in the form of a prayer. So it's all actually directed to God in the second person. But in that opening paragraph, this will be familiar to you. Augustine says, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." You have made us for yourself. There's a design claim there, right? You have made us for yourself, but our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And the fantastic thing about Augustine's confessions is, on the one hand, you see him working through philosophical issues. He has to sort out intellectual problems. Without question. But the turning point in Book 8 of the Confessions is precisely when he realizes, well, he knows it all. He's figured it out intellectually, but he's not a Christian. Why? Because he knows that his heart is still oriented to other gods. His heart still wants other things. And the real conversion takes place in Augustine's life, not when he finally figures out the intellectual problems that he needs to solve, but when the Spirit grabs hold of his heart. You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. In fact, the first five books of Augustine's Confessions is really the story of someone looking for love in all the wrong places. You've seen was it Urban Cowboy? The terrible John Travolta. And there's, I can't remember if it's Eddie Rabbit or, but looking for love in all the wrong places. Look, that is an Augustinian song. Deeply Augustinian song. Because what Augustine says is this. Because God has made us to love, and God has made us to love him, and because the seat and core of the human person is the heart, the effect of sin and fallenness and brokenness is not that it turns off our loves. Very important. For Augustine, the question isn't whether you love. It's what you love. There's no question. You are human. You are going to love something as ultimate. I think it's the same point when John Calvin describes the human heart as an idol factory. You can't turn it off. It can't worship. The human heart can't not worship. Why? Because the human heart can't not love. And what will happen then is that the disordered heart, the broken heart, the fallen heart goes looking for love in all the wrong places. And sort of idolizes features of God's creation rather than the Creator known in Jesus Christ. So think of the fulcrum of our loves as the heart. And one of the themes I want us to think through this week, and I think this is something that we as Protestants probably can't hear too much of, is I was going to say something from the Bible again. But, well, okay. My understanding is, I'll qualify it this way. My understanding is that actually that biblical, that New Testament word for heart, cardia, is not the pumping organ that we think of. It actually names something more like your bowels, your gut. And so what's interesting is that the biblical picture of the seat and core of the human person is moved down to this gut level, because that's where your loves are. And one of the things I'm going to invite us to think about this week is, what is the significance of embodiment for spiritual formation? What is the significance of the fact that God creates us as holistic creatures who aren't just minds trucking around in the body as a vehicle, but as embodied souls who are made in material flesh? What is the significance of that insight for spiritual formation and worship? I think that's one of the themes that we'll explore together. What I want us to appreciate this morning, though, is that the seat of our loves is then at this kind of gut level, which is precisely why we don't always love what we think. Now, here's one other feature of this model, of thinking about the human person in this way. By the way, this is I have not had an original idea in 20 years. This is St. Augustine meets Thomas Aquinas meets John Calvin meets Jonathan Edwards. And I'm just, it's a dubstep mix, my kids would say. Now, here's the feature then, the way we think about love. Love is a habit. Love is a habit. I totally understand why we sometimes make the point that love is a choice. Do you know what I mean? Like you're doing pre-marriage counseling and you're trying to emphasize this is not an emotion. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. One of the things I struggle with in offering this model and talking about the heart and the importance of love is... Oprah has kind of stolen all the best ways of talking about the heart, but it's just that I everything that you've learned about the heart from Hallmark, I need you to forget, because we're not talking about emotivism here. Okay, we're not just talking about emotions. We're talking about something deeper than that. Love. It's right that on the one hand, when I make a promise to my wife to love her, that is a commitment, it's a covenant, that's a decision. But there's another way and level and mode in which to think of love as a habit. Now, habits are, in the theological and philosophical tradition, are internal dispositions to an end. Okay? A habit is an internal disposition towards some end. Good habits we call virtues. Right? Virtues are good habits that you've acquired, these sort of internal dispositions that have become woven into your character. They've become part of the fiber of who you are, so that now you are the kind of person, if you are virtuous, who has an internal disposition to the good, to a good end. What would bad habits be? Vices. Okay? Vices are habits that we've acquired that actually dispose us away from the good end. Does that make sense for everybody? So love then is a virtue. I think this is exactly the way Paul... I'm talking about the Bible a lot here for having promised not. But it's all right. I have permission as a philosopher. Read Colossians 3 verses 12 to 17. In fact, in the NIV translation, they explicitly use the word virtues to talk about compassion, forgiveness, and above all, put on love. Love then is this fundamental virtue, passion, disposition that orients us to an end. But what Augustine is going to say, remember we said it's not a question of whether you love, it's a question of what you love. And so now the question is your love rightly ordered? The right order of love is to be formed as the one now who does have a disposition towards the Creator as known in Christ and met in Christ, so that you become someone for whom this is second nature. It's a really cool... I'm sorry, I'm devolving into virtue theory here, but I'll just say this. When philosophers and theologians have historically talked about the virtues and habits, one of the ways that we talk about is that, say, once you've acquired a virtue, it becomes second nature. Yeah, we use that phrase, right? Second nature. What does it mean when we say that something is second nature? It means that actually you do it without thinking about it. Like all the things in first nature. Like I didn't wake up this morning and think, oh, I should start breathing. No, because it's now so woven into, well, not so, it always has been, woven into my nature, my first nature, that I am the kind of creature who breathes. Now, isn't this a cool way to think about virtue? Virtues become second nature when you so become the kind of person that these are woven into your character in such a way that you are that. And you do it without thinking. That actually is what it means to be in the image of Christ. And that, in a way, is, we're Calvinists, so that's a teleological ideal. But it's something that one imagines as working towards. So, final piece of this model. And this is, in a way, think of this last piece as something we're going to unpack over the next 2 days. If love is a habit, if we're defined by what we love, and love is a habit, that is, it's sort of, your heart is trained. Now the question we should ask ourselves is, how does our love get aimed? If I am what I love, and I can't not love something ultimate, the question is, well, how does my love get aimed at the right end or the wrong end? And the answer to that question is not thinking. I wish it was. I so wish it was. I wish it was a question of me just making sure I went to the right conference or heard the right sermon on a Sunday so that when I woke up in the morning on Monday, I finally had the information I needed so that my loves could be rightly ordered to Jesus Christ and His kingdom. But it doesn't work that way. Because I've got a lot of information. But information is not what forms our habits. Formation is what primes and aims and directs our habits. Well, what kind of formation? This is where we're going to spend time this week talking about practices and liturgies. Liturgies, I'm going to try to expand our use of that term a little bit so that we don't just think of it as a churchy thing on Sundays. Liturgies are love-ordering practices, love-ordering rituals that we are immersed in that work on us at the gut level, affectively. They actually get to us through our bodies. Because of that, however, this is what we need to realize. There are all kinds of liturgies that are disordering my loves. Right? How do I learn to love wrongly? It's also not based on information. I don't come to be the sort of person who is wrongly ordered or is pursuing the wrong things because somebody sits down and says, I think if you had this piece of information, you would choose to pursue that idol. We don't become idolaters. Because we're convinced intellectually. We become idolaters because our imaginations are recruited affectively. Our loves are trained by disordered liturgies. And so one of the things we're going to think about this week in terms of spiritual renewal and spiritual formation is how important it is to recognize that disordering so that we can then think about what is renewal. How can we be intentional about retraining our loves and longings? That's kind of where I don't want to ruin the story now, but that's where we're headed. Think of it this way: what is it that moves us to action? What is it that moves us in our behavior? It is actually not so much the outcome of conscious, rational, deliberative processes. See, if you have this intellectualist, talking head, bobblehead picture of the human person, what you'll think is, well, the way we get people to live like Jesus is by depositing the right information in their heads. And if we can just get the right information in their heads, then what will happen is they will think through their choices and they'll conclude to choices that look like Jesus. A funny thing happened on the way to behavior, which was this. And this is one of those places where I think a lot of contemporary research in neuroscience, cognitive science, social psychology is a very important resource for those of us in ministry and thinking about spiritual formation. In fact, speaking of David Brooks' book, The Social Animal, is a wonderful journalistic kind of summary of these insights. Think of the insights simply this way. Human consciousness is like an iceberg. And all the rational, conscious, deliberative parts that we tend to emphasize if you have a thinking thing of the human person are really just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, Timothy Wilson at the University of Virginia, in a book called Strangers to Ourselves, which is also a very Augustinian title, says that actually in any given day, about 5 to 7% of your actions are the outcomes of conscious, rational, deliberative choice. The rest is governed by processes under the water of that iceberg, which are the power of habit. The power of habit. Think of a very simple illustration of this. How many of you have ever trained a teenager to drive? Okay? You survived. I have learned that playing praise and worship music while I'm sitting in the passenger seat goes a long ways to sort of just calming me down a little bit. My daughter Madison is learning to drive right now. And in addition to being terrifying, it's also sort of a really interesting study because think of a young person who is learning to drive is actually processing everything in that executive, conscious, deliberative aspect of consciousness, right? So when you're learning to drive, you do actually have to think about everything. So it's like, where's my signal? Where's the lights? Where's my blind spot? You know, check the mirror. You actually have to consciously think through all of that. Now, contrast that with us. You had a staff meeting that didn't. Let's pretend this is fiction. You had a staff meeting that didn't go that well. You're frustrated. You're driving home, and all of a sudden you're in your driveway, and you don't remember driving home. Right? Have you ever had that happen? You get somewhere and you don't remember driving there? Why? Because actually you have so automated and habituated the sort of processes you need to drive that it doesn't have to be in your conscious awareness at all. It's all operating under the hood at the level of habit. I want to suggest that that is a very, very important insight for spiritual formation. Spiritual formation, sanctification, is rehabituation. Now, again, this is one of those places where sometimes as Protestants we go, we have a little bit of hang up with that. I'm gonna walk you back from the ledge in that regard. I want you to come to think about habit as a good word. I even want you to think about ritual as a good word. Because if you don't, all the secular liturgies are going to win. If we don't take habit seriously, if we don't recognize the formative power of ritual, all of the rituals of our culture are going to keep recruiting our loves while we're spending time trying to make sure everybody's got all the right ideas and beliefs sorted out in their heads. Okay? This is a contest in a way that we need to think through. I have an embarrassing example of this. So my wife, Deanna, is a master gardener, a gourmet cook, and is really passionately devoted to good eating. You wouldn't know this from me just because I'm non-compliant, all right? Good eating in two senses. So she both believes in eating well, eating healthy, eating local, all that, but she also believes in good food systems, So she's a big fan of Barbara Kingsolver and Michael Pollan and Wendell Berry and folks like that, if you're familiar with that. So she has constantly been trying to sort of press this, and I'm I actually have a very deep appreciation for this. But a few years ago, she finally convinced me to take this seriously. So I read a fantastic little anthology, by Wendell Berry, called Bringing It to the Table. If you don't know Wendell Berry, this is actually a great entree. And I'm reading this, and Barry is basically saying everything Deanna has been saying for 10 years, but because somebody else is saying it, I believe it now. Do you know how that works? Yeah. So I'm listening to this, and I'm like engrossed by the argument. I totally get it. I am with him. I'm marking up every page. I'm one of those guys who always has a book with me, because you never know when you might have 15 seconds of downtime. So this was the book I was carrying with me in the car and everything. And at one point I was reading Wendell Berry's critique of, you know, unjust food systems and bad eating. And I'm like, yes, you know, sort of saying amen in my mind and all these check marks. And I stop to pensively reflect on this. And I realize that I'm reading Wendell Berry in the food court at Costco. Now, if you know anything about Wendell Berry, Costco is kind of everything that is wrong with the world. It's like the sixth circle of hell in Wendell Berry's inferno. But those footlongs, man, I'm telling you. So what's going on here? The illustration is simply this. What's going on is the gap between my intellectual conviction and my habitual orientation. Right? What that episode illustrates is that it is not... Wendell Berry totally convinced me intellectually. He gave me new knowledge, new information, made powerful arguments. I got it. I believed it. I even wanted to be that guy. Oh, you don't know how much I want to be the guy who likes broccoli. Like, I want to be that guy. But here I am eating a hot dog in the Costco food court because I'm not that guy. Why? Because my habits have not yet been recruited. Maybe I've got it in my intellect, but it hasn't yet converted my imagination. It hasn't yet recruited my wants and my longing. And the gap between reading a book by Wendell Berry and becoming the person who wants that is a gap that is filled with practices, with formation, not more information. It's not like, okay, what's the next book I need to read so that I finally become that person? No. It's not about information at this point. It's about formation. And it's about the formation of our loves and our longings and our habits, our most fundamental desires. And how does that happen? It happens in liturgies. Now, as I've already suggested, we'll talk more about this tomorrow. It happens in disordered liturgies, or it can happen in rightly ordered liturgies that are aimed and indexed to Jesus Christ and his coming kingdom. So to think about spiritual formation, we need to really embrace what I'm calling this incarnational principle, which is that God meets us where we are. Is there anything that is such a hermeneutic arc in the entirety of Scripture? From Genesis to Revelation and hinging on John 1, the overwhelming message of grace is that God, the creator of the cosmos, meets us where we are. He becomes flesh for us. We are creatures of habit. That is no surprise to the creator of the universe. And so God meets us as creatures of habit and gives us, in his spirit, gifts of practices to rehabituate us. That is the gift that we receive from the Scriptures. That is the gift I want us to think about receiving from the history of the church. Now, this is why I want to suggest that worship is, in a way, the center and hub of spiritual formation, of Christian discipleship. Now, we do have to be intentional about that. I don't think everything that necessarily calls itself worship will actually form our habits in that way. And I will say, in case I don't think to say this again later this week, I would say one of the first hurdles that we need to get over, especially in North American Christianity, is to stop thinking of worship as only and primarily expressive and recover what I think is a deeply Reformed and Presbyterian intuition, actually, but also historically Catholic, that worship is formative. Worship isn't just an expressive, bottom-up, we offer our sacrifice of praise to God. It is a formative encounter in which God meets us and is shaping us and transforming us. So the primary value in worship is not just sincerity. See, if you only think of worship as expressive, then the only really measure of quote-unquote good worship is, does it breed authenticity, sincerity, those kinds of things. But here's the deal. You can actually be sincerely expressive and not being formed by the gospel. So one of the reasons why I believe that the history of Christian reflection on formation and liturgy is such a gift to the contemporary church is because it invites us to remember something that we've forgotten, which is that worship is an encounter with God. And it's a place where God meets us and molds us and makes us and wants to shape us in the story of God in Christ reconciling the whole world to himself. So one of the things, I'm here as an unapologetic advocate for liturgy, very intentional historic liturgy, precisely because I think it has postmodern power. I will also say this, and I don't know what sorts of creatures pastors are. I say this actually as an academic. The overwhelming emphasis on worship as expressive in contemporary North American Christianity it breeds Christianity for extroverts. Now, here's why I'm going to step on a little soapbox for a moment and then I'll stop. I actually care about this a lot because we all hear all these sort of horror stories about young people walking away from the faith, okay? I want us to entertain the possibility that for some of our young people, that happens because they're not extroverts. But the only Christianity that they have ever encountered in their youth groups, whatever it might be, and in a lot of their churches, is one which says, if you really love Jesus, you have to be an extrovert because you have to be super expressive about everything. And if they're not wired that way, they think and say, they accept it. They basically say, yeah, I guess that is, if that's what it means to really follow Jesus. But I can't do that. So I guess I can't follow Jesus. Friends, they're not walking away from Jesus at that point. They're walking away from the way that we have packaged Christian spirituality in our extroverted, expressive culture. I have found, working with young people, college-age students, For young people like that who are like on the verge and they're like, I don't know about this whole Christianity thing because I actually see all that and I'm like, no, I don't want any of that. And you give them something like the Book of Common Prayer or you introduce them to the Divine Hours and you say, you know what? You don't have to make this up. You don't have to like be all novel in your spirituality. Here's the Psalms to pray every single day. And friends, it is the gift of tongues for them. Do you know why? Because it gives them a way to pray and follow Jesus that they couldn't have come up with on their own, and they receive it as an absolute gift. And so while we're trying to spend our time thinking, what's the next novel, cool way that we can keep 20-year-olds in the church? I'm suggesting, this is a wager, I'm suggesting that actually they will wake up to the strangeness of ancient transcendence. I will never forget an episode in which our family was in Paris. We were visiting Sacré-Cœur up in the hill in Montmartre. We were poor academics at the time. My oldest son, Grayson, who is not at all given to expressive piety, we told each of the kids that they could have 2 euros that day. Don't spend it all in one place. But that's kind of where we were at. And so we said, you can each have 2 euros that day. My son Grayson used his 2 euros to light a candle in Sacré-Cœur. This is not a kid who loved youth group, if you know what I mean. But there was something tangible, physical, strange, ancient. And I cling to that picture in a lot of ways. I think it says something about what people are longing for. I think it confirms our intuition, and I'll stop with this, that we are liturgical animals. To say that God has created us as creatures of habit is to say that we are liturgical animals. And while the church, insofar as it buys into the intellectual, heady, bobblehead picture of modernity, forgets that, actually, a lot of the culture remembers it. It knows that we are liturgical animals. That's why it offers rival liturgies that are recruiting our loves to other kingdoms, to other gods.